Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today, my guest, Peter Phillips, breaks down who runs the world. Yeah, in simple terms, his book is called Giants, and he profiles the global power elite. He names names. He shows the incestuous, interlocking corporate boards that a small group of individuals, under 400, serve on. And from that perch, they pretty well control our futures. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who support my work with your subscriptions, like Paul Tomaselli, John Cisney, just renewed his annual subscription. Thank you, John. Also, Ethan Knox and Brian Massey. They kick in $5 a month. You can do it, too. Just visit peterbcollins.com. Click on Menu, then click on Become a Subscriber. You'll land on the sign-up page, and you can figure it out from there. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting my work at peterbcollins.com. Today on the Peter B. Collins Podcast, Professor Peter Phillips talks about his new book, Giants, the Global Power Elite. And he has enumerated 199 people who sit on the interlocking boards that have dramatic influence over transnational global corporations. Phillips is professor of political sociology at Sonoma State University. He edited 14 editions of Censored, and that is the annual product of Project Censored, which analyzes the failures, mostly, of the corporate media to provide honest and comprehensive coverage of the world we live in. He was also co-host of the weekly Project Censored radio show syndicated across the country on Pacifica Radio. He won the Firecracker Alternative Book Award for Best Political Book back in 1997, and he is honored in many other ways. Peter Phillips, thanks for joining me today on the Peter B. Collins Podcast.
Well, Peter, thank you very much for having me on.
And before we dive into your really important book, Giants, I just want to credit you and Mickey Huff and others at Project Censored for declaring some 10-plus years ago that here in the United States, we live in a truth emergency, and that this is really part of the failure of the media in this country to give us the information that we deserve and are entitled to. What is the status? How would you rank the status of truth in America today, Peter?
Well, we've been talking about the idea of a truth emergency now for a decade plus, and held a conference in Santa Cruz on that topic a decade ago, and really believe that it's continued to get worse. And, you know, the idea that there's, you know, fake news, we were talking along those lines a long time ago in terms of stories that are managed by corporate media, by big public relation firms that control content. And that, of course, gets involved in political party disputes and lies back and forth and misrepresentations, and it becomes confusing to the public as to what's really going on. And that's why we, of course, work really hard on the idea of critical media and independent news sources that we learn that we can trust.
Mm-hmm. And Project Censored's work continues. You retired from that, but you continue to teach, and I know you're still deeply involved. For listeners who don't know about Carl Jensen's creation, give us a thumbnail of Project Censored, Peter.
Well, it was 1976, and Carl was teaching a class on media, and the students were asking how Watergate didn't get covered in the corporate media, or how come Nixon got elected, and when Watergate was happening, and they go back and look, and Watergate really didn't get covered in the corporate media. Most people didn't know about it, or if they did, it was just peripheral. And so he started to think, well, I wonder what else isn't being covered, and came up with the idea of Project Censored, and then the students would look for independent news stories that hadn't been covered in the corporate media. They made a list every year and put it out as a press release. And then the alternative news weeklies started to pick that up, and those were in cities all over the country. So that's how it kind of grew. And then, you know, a dozen years later, he started to put out books. And at 20 years, he retired, and I took it over for 14.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to what extent were the students who participate in Project Censored the research team for your book, Giants?
There was about a dozen plus students who were involved in data collection for me with Giants. Being a university professor, you can give students credit for doing work, all that in-depth online research work that we did with individuals in Giants as to who they were and the corporations they were affiliated with. So I had a couple dozen over the years that had done work on various pieces of the book. All of them are acknowledged, of course, in the book, and thanked very much.
I saw that, yes. So I want to begin our conversation with some recent news items, Peter. The New York Times reported on December 17th that Goldman Sachs is facing criminal charges both in Malaysia and in the United States relative to its advisory role to the government that fleeced the public there for billions of dollars. And on top of that, the Times this past Sunday ran a front page story following up on their coverage of McKinsey, which is a big international consulting company that is nominally flagged in the United States. And prior to that, the Times, I recognize the limits of the New York Times, but I also am willing to praise them when they do investigative and enterprise reporting. And I give them credit. It was in October. They published a piece about how not only McKinsey, but Booz Allen Hamilton and others have been advising the Saudis and the Chinese and the Malaysians. And it really does form a network that is a shadow state. The deep state term is being a little overused these days. But I think it is a network of power and the powerful that in many respects overshadows the elected governments or the dictatorships that they are that they consider to be their clients.
Well, these dictatorships that they're working with, they're cooperating with global capital. In other words, these companies allow global capital penetration into their states. They allow exploitation of workers and people, and they allow the growth and repatriation of profits. So they're cooperative dictatorships. And when you have cooperative dictatorships with global capital, then McKinsey and Booz Allen Hamilton and the others are, it's fair game for them to get consulting contracts and try to help them grow and expand and develop. But it's also no problem either that if fudging is going on, or like with, like the LIBOR price fixing scandal, it's back to 2003, all the major banks were involved in that. They knew that the benchmark rates were being fixed with fake data. They all gained money from mortgages and commercial loans and profited off of it. They paid, in some cases, billions of dollars in fines. But for them, it's really just the cost of doing business. So the opportunity for illegal actions or actions that exploit others is continuing always possible inside global capital. And these big management companies are capable of helping manipulate that on the side.
And the Times reports that McKinsey often works both sides of the street. They, again, are an American company, but they have advised China on its build-out of the so-called Spratly Islands that are contested in the South China Sea. They worked in Ukraine alongside Paul Manafort to fleece the Ukrainian people, along with Viktor Yanukovych, the kleptocrat, who was nonetheless the proper leader who was taken out in an American-backed coup. And so we see the overlapping interests of American foreign policy and the economic policies of these shadowy networks.
Well, certainly that's true. In the case of Ukraine, the U.S. engineered a coup using basically the what was left over of fascist networks from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But the interests there were getting global capital's penetration into the Ukraine and pushing the Russians out. They, of course, sell gas to Ukraine in mass quantities, and Ukraine is literally dependent upon them. But there was the goal to get you know, investment capital, and ultimately maybe move Ukraine into NATO. All of this is engineered as a policy of continuation of the Cold War and the undermining of Russia, particularly since Putin became the leader there. We had some penetration after when Yeltsin was in command. And when I say penetration, I'm talking about global capital penetration.
Mm-hmm.
So there's trillions and trillions of dollars that are open for investment. Elites and the global power elite have more money than they've got places to invest it. And they're literally salivating over the idea of investing widely in Russia in the gas and oil and mineral rights that are in that vast region. And have been trying for a long time to, you know, to get that to happen. We see, you know, and Putin was, of course, resisting that and trying to improve and had improved dramatically the working class in Russia in terms of their position and decreasing poverty and the impacts that happened after the collapse of the Soviet Union. That has been an ongoing piece of what he's been doing. And challenging the U.S. interests in a variety of ways, particularly in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
I think the point where we're now in Syria, we're going to withdraw all our troops and say, oh, we won the war, we got rid of ISIS. The real goal was there was to overthrow the Syrian government and have a regime change. And that had been the number one agenda from right on.
Well, let's pause and talk about that for a moment, because we're speaking on the 20th of December, and yesterday by tweet, Trump announced that he's ordering the withdrawal of U.S. troops. That is something that I think is an important and positive decision, but it's being treated as this you know, another aberration by this bizarre president, and no one is raising the simple question about whether the U.S. Had any positive role in Syria. Nobody's talking about the need for peace in order to stabilize and rebuild that country, and you know, this is being treated as oh gosh, we've got to stay there. We're committed to this, you know, expansion of imperialism in the Middle East.
Well, that was the original intent, was to have a regime change and allow greater capital penetration. The government there was, of course, benefiting the people. And when you have a dictator that has basically an agreement with the people, I'm going to give you free education all the way through university, you know, we'll make sure that you have jobs and adequate resources, you just don't interfere in my government. For some people, that's a fairly decent deal, and there's stability and peace. So but that doesn't allow global capital to penetrate there in a free flow that has to go through the government. And we got rid of Saddam Hussein, who was starting to sell his oil in euros. We got rid of Gaddafi, who wanted to sell his oil and was organizing African countries to sell their oil in gold. And so we wanted to get rid of the change, have a regime change in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, resistance fighters were shipped in all those countries to make it look like there was resistance and flow. Civil unrest and chaos was going on. That was part of the formation of ISIS. Some of those fighters had been around since Afghanistan and had been used in Bosnia and other places when we were bombing Serbia, and continue to be proxy forces for U.S. interests or capital interests. These would include Europeans as well,
mm-hmm.
Worldwide, to create and promote regime changes when governments aren't cooperating with capital.
Well, I think that is a brilliant analysis, and I think that it underscores that what Trump has done is finally repudiated the failed policies of Barack Obama. And the dual goals of taking out this phony opponent, the Islamic State, while they were surrounded by all these proxy fighters supported by Saudi and the Emirates and other outsiders. And it was a strategy that could never have succeeded. The idea that you could remove the Islamic State and its caliphate at the same time that you take out the Assad government is just absurd. And there is, of course, nobody waiting outside Langley to be inserted as the new savior for Syria. And so while, you know, once again, I think Trump made a bungle of this by trying to use Twitter and, you know, failing to adhere to normal diplomatic processes, I'm one of the people who says this is the right move.
Well, absolutely. I totally agree with you. We shouldn't have our forces anywhere in the Middle East engaged in this sort of thing, let alone all of Africa and 800 bases worldwide and forces, you know, operating and killing people in 140 countries. All of that's wrong, of course, and that's part of empire. But overall, it's about protecting global capital. And one of the problems with global capital is they have more capital than they know what to do with. So Western governments accommodate that by having a situation of permanent war. Wars are very profitable. Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing all are selling weapons and material to the Saudis, and they're engaged in a war. So it's all very profitable for global capital. It helps use the excess capital that exists in the world and get a return on it. So one of the functions of permanent war is profit for general capital, concentrated capital, that's really managed by just these 17 giant investment companies that control in 2017 control $41 trillion worth of wealth. So that's Vanguard and J.P. Morgan Chase and BlackRock and UBS and Bank of America. I mean, They control trillions of dollars, and they're managed by just this 199 people that you mentioned earlier. So it's a very concentrated group of people controlling trillions of dollars of wealth. And this is other people's wealth. So this is billionaires and millionaires who put their money in investment companies to get a return. And that capital needs places to go. And there's not enough companies like Amazon, which they're way over invested in, and that's what's made Bezos the richest person in the world. But there's not enough places in terms of that 40 to 50 trillion now to put it, so that they're looking for other opportunities. And that includes expansion throughout Africa, out the world. They're hoping that a regime change can happen in Russia so they can expand there, and engaging in war and engaging in austerity measures where they, you know, push Western governments or any third world governments to stop spending money on their people, pay off their debts and their bills, borrow for infrastructure that will help support global capital expansion, building ports and rail lines and other things, and making their elites rich, and then building police state military structures to control the population so that nation states become population containment zones.
And what you just described applies most recently to Greece.
Absolutely. Greece, Italy, Spain, I mean, all of those are seeing resistance from people, young people in particular, who have no jobs, are in debt, and what used to be government supported, you know, support for education and healthcare and that is being diminished. So we see the same thing even in the U.S., where the college students a day are now in have $1.4 trillion of student loan debt that they can't get rid of in bankruptcy. I mean, so this is permanent debt for them, and it protects global capital. It's one place where capital continues to get a return, and it's an exploitative process.
Peter, in Giants, you write, these 17 giants have 199 directors on their boards. This group of individuals represents the financial management core of global capitalism. And you mentioned the $41 trillion figure, operating in nearly every country in the world. They are the central decision makers regarding the financial capital that powers the global economic system. Western governments and international policy bodies tend to work in the interests of this power elite financial core to protect the free flow of capital investment and debt collection everywhere in the world. And Peter, this book is so rich in detail. And one of the real takeaways that I got was not only how incestuous these boards are, the 199 or just under 400 when you expand it beyond the financial services firms, but how incestuous their investments are. They each have investments in the other. And so we have a system that is too big to fail, and it is too big to regulate, at least on a meaningful basis, by any single government.
I think we always kind of assume that, but as I was studying the NASDAQ investment policies for these giant investment companies, the ones that were public, I started seeing they're all invested in each other. So we calculated the number, and we found out under NASDAQ investments, there was $400 billion. Those 17 companies had over $400 billion invested in each other, and that was just like a quarter of all their investments. So it's a giant network of capital with a small number of firms all interconnected in one giant cluster of centralized control.
And is that simply a group of MBAs who are sharing their risk? Or is this pooled in a way that goes beyond, financial rationales?
I'm not sure I understand the question that you're asking here. Well, many of them are MBAs.
Well, no, what I'm
128 of them went to Harvard or Stanford.
Well, what I'm referring to is staff people who say, okay, we want BlackRock to invest in Vanguard and Bank of America, and those firms will invest in us as well. And is this simply sharing the risk, as an MBA is trained to do, or does it go beyond that into elements of power and political control?
Well, there's certainly some collusion going on in the sense of the investment packages look very similar. So one Bank of America may have, $40 billion invested in BlackRock, or $20 billion, and BlackRock will have that much or close to it in Bank of America. So it looks almost deliberate, and it's a building of a network of shared global capital interests and risk management that kind of permeates the entire system.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly at the top, and then there's another set of what we call near giants. Those are $800 billion or more in terms of wealth, and then there was new giants that had emerged in 2018. So this whole network of like 40 companies is well in excess of $50 trillion, and they're all invested in each other. And they will have what are called these exchange-traded fund accounts, which are just kind of like stock or iShares, and they open that up to each other, and anybody can invest in a company into these shared stocks, these exchange-traded fund shares, that allow you or I to put our little savings in there as well.
Mm-hmm. And is there, do you consider it to be a top-down system? BlackRock is at the top of the heap. And if they decide to get in or out of a sector, does everybody else follow suit?
Well, you would. They all certainly would know if BlackRock got a conscience and decided not to invest in petroleum anymore. And, you know, that we're going to save the world and stop investing in gas and burning gas, and then we're going to force people to engage in green technologies. And if BlackRock directors got a conscience, I think that if some of them did, they'd probably get pushed out. But let's say that they did. That would, I think, have a huge impact on the rest of the system as well. Because then if you're Vanguard, you'd think, well, wow, what are the impacts going to be here? If BlackRock is going to participate and they represent 10% of the global capital in this case or more, that will have an impact that could affect the share. So, yeah, I mean, but they will watch each other very closely. And I'm sure there's a lot of telephone conversations back and forth in regards to different issues. There's not that many people. They see each other at Davos every year. They go to the Commercial Bank Association meetings. I mean, you know, it's a small network mm-hmm. of people.
Mm-hmm. And to what extent do you believe that they control the political process in nations that have one?
Like totally?
Mm-hmm.
I meant that kind of like total control.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't run for Congress without a pile of money.
Mm-hmm.
You're not a senator without a pile of money and backup from these groups. Certainly with Citizens United in the U.S., it's unlimited spending. So they spend huge amounts of money, and they put huge amounts of money in companies that are also politically engaged in a variety of ways with lobby groups and that sort of thing. So it's a vast network. But what's focused here and what we focus on in the book is concentrated global capital and the people managing it. So this isn't just, you know, the oil companies or mineral wealth or the defense contractors. All of those are part of this, and all of those are invested heavily by these giants. But the core of it is concentrated global capital and the inability of that capital to have a good return without buying up public resources or without war. And it's, I mean, capital is like riding a bicycle. It has to keep moving forward, and if it doesn't keep moving forward, it falls over, and that's called stagnation. And that's massive unemployment, and nobody's buying anything, and it could be serious inflation. I mean, that's catastrophic to the world. It's catastrophic to all of us if that kind of economic collapse happens. But it's inevitable. And I think that the global power elite know that it's inevitable. The capitalism can't continue to grow and concentrate ad infinitum without having a really strict police state and control over the world populations. And in doing that, of course, they are destroying the world environmentally. And so we're faced with, these global warming increases and the CO2 and collusion, which was reported, of course, by the New York Times last week of the oil companies and the Koch brothers colluding to kind of get the miles per gallon reduced at a state level using ALEC around the country. So those kinds of manipulations are ongoing by the powerful all the time.
Peter, in the book, as I mentioned, it is rich in detail. You name these names. You show the roles that they play in various organizations. And if you don't mind, I just want to pick one to go a little deep on to give people an idea of what you cover here. And that is this group called the Atlantic Council. And to most people, that just comes off as another think tank that they know very little about. But give us the dimensions of the Atlantic Council and the role it attempts to play.
Well, the Atlantic Council was established in 1961 as a voluntary alliance of countries in the North Atlantic Treaty. But it's really, I call them the protectors, because they're the ones protecting global capital advising NATO, advising the U.S. military and intelligence agencies in terms of policy recommendations. There's 146 people on the Atlantic Council from 28 countries. They're well represented from Boeing, Raytheon, Bechtel, Lockheed Martin, all the big defense contractors, Booz Allen Hamilton, who we were talking about earlier, Carlyle Group. 41 of their directors are active in government or private security organizations, such as the National Security Council and that. Over half their people are involved in major capital investment companies. And so they are the sort of the protective arm of the global power elite, and I name them as part of the global power elite network, who are engaged in advising governments the policies that they should be implementing. And in this case, the Atlantic Council was advising Facebook as to what accounts should be deleted. Recently, that's what we came out this year. So they're a very powerful group of people, and they're privately funded. And that's when I talk about these policy groups that are non-governmental. They're privately funded. The Atlantic Council is one. That the Trilateral Commission is the other that's global. And then what I call the Executive Committee of Global Capitalism is the Council of 30, which is 32 individuals. 31 men, one woman, although they just added another woman because they were sensitive about that. And these are the top bankers and economic consultants in the world meet at the Council of 30 in Washington, D.C. with a private budget. This is not governmental funded. And they put out reports that are seen as direction and instruction by governments and by transnational money management companies like World Bank, International Monetary Fund, and those.
Now, Peter, you invited us as we read this chapter about the Atlantic Council to browse the brief resumes or the summaries that you write about the 35 members of their executive committee. And the very final entry caught my attention because Ellen Tauscher served as a member of Congress from the Bay Area for about 10 years. She resigned to become a special arms control advisor to the Obama administration. But she had a fortune of her own from an office products company before she went into Congress. And now she sits on the board of BAE Systems, that's a weapons company, SeaWorld, Southern California Edison, eHealth, Caldwell and Berkowitz PC, and she draws hefty compensation for serving on these boards, over $1 million a year. And she serves also on other operations, the Nuclear Threat Initiative, the Council on Foreign Relations, Executive Committee of the Atlantic Council, National Endowment for Democracy. Now let's pause there and talk about what the NED really is.
The NED is promotes global capital freedom worldwide. So it's companies' freedom to do business. And they'll call it, they'll say that, yeah, this is freedom for people, but it's really freedom for companies and protecting capital expansion and growth in various governments around the world and or funding groups like in Venezuela that will challenge the government there that's in power, elected by two-thirds of the people and has a socialist orientation. So they are a private nonprofit group that is engaged in policies and government manipulations worldwide. So Tauscher, Ellen, she's a typical person who's on multiple boards of directors. So she's on the Southern California Edison Company board. She gets $250,000 just for that. I looked up all of the companies that these people were on, read their proxy reports, found out their stock ownership and how much they were being paid. They get free stock for being on these companies. So they become instantly, if you're on four or five boards, you're literally an instant multimillionaire.
Well, and we know these corporate boards exercise great control over the companies that they're tasked with running, firing CEOs, cutting their salaries and their stock option. Oh, I'm sorry. That was a daydream, Peter.
Right, exactly. That's not what happens. I mean, everybody gets rich. It's like Sears shutting down and all the elites, the thousands of employees get laid off and all the elites get a big bonus.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I mean, yeah, it works that way. And so by identifying these people, I mean, most people wouldn't know of Ellen Tosher.
Right. No, she was a non-entity in Congress.
Right. But, you know, that she went to, she's on the, you know, Livermore National Security Group. Mm-hmm. She's been involved with the Los Alamos National Security, Inc. And she's executive committee of the Atlantic Council and National Endowment for Democracy, the Cancer Networks. I mean, she's on everything. She's very, very rich, and is networked quite strongly, and is part of the Atlantic Council. So she's one of the top 35 executives on the Atlantic Council board that decides whether or not it's time to overthrow Maduro in Venezuela.
Mm-hmm. Peter, you also take aim at what you call the ideologists, corporate media and public relations propaganda firms selling empire, war, and capitalism. And this hits close at home for me because, you know, I worked in corporate media as kind of fancied myself as a bit of an inside agitator. But I recognize the role that for-profit media plays, and it's not a pretty one. And it's gotten much worse in the aftermath of 9/11, in my opinion, where, you know, media is much more stenographic. And we have, you know, occasional outbursts of investigative reporting and exposés like these New York Times stories that I referenced at the beginning of our conversation. But everybody knows that this is window dressing. It's theater. And that the elite and powerful can bat this stuff away by hiring public relations firms that will re-spin the facts. Right now, Johnson & Johnson is furiously trying to claim that its baby powder and talc products are safe, don't have asbestos, that they've never hidden this. And it's a big lie that is being published in full-page ads in newspapers across the country every day right now. And so we've seen the monetization of news and information to the point that when you add the sophisticated market research that big companies and networks are able to do, and then you add, of course, all the data that Facebook, Google, and other tech companies have collected on us, and this is a picture of declining truth against a very expansive machine that manufactures things that people are led to believe are true.
Well, yeah. There are six giant transnational news and entertainment corporations: Comcast, Disney, Time Warner, Fox, Bartleman's, and Viacom. Those are the six big ones that are broadcasting television, daily news to the world. They are, in fact, all deeply invested in by the giants, and or some of them are more privately owned by individual rich families. But they all have, you know, very, very centered monetary investment in global capital. And that is the agenda items in terms of news content. They don't even necessarily collect the news. The news is provided to them by public relation firms, big PR companies like Omnicom, WPP, and Interpublic Group, which are literally producing and providing 2/3 to 80% of the content news for global television. And, of course, the Pentagon is in there, but the Pentagon will hire public relation firms to produce their stories as well. So content is managed. So what the public gets to see or what the public gets to find out is managed news from a pro-capital orientation that never criticizes capitalism and is constantly negating Putin or anybody else that might be challenging global capital, Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, of course. And those are constantly, you have negative stories, and the attitudes that are evolved here among the public are all very negative as well, unless you're well-read and understand what's really happening. So that, you know, this is a global ideological mind control mechanism of keeping populations of the world entertained and uninformed.
Peter, let me just focus on one word, and this may seem trivial to some people. But I always wonder, who is the decision maker who gets to decide whether a government is called a government or a regime? Regime has become one of these loaded terms that appears in newspaper headlines and, you know, is used so casually to describe governments, but it often conveys a payload of subconscious messaging.
Well, that and of course, when we say we want a regime change, that means that we're going to try to get rid of somebody who's not cooperating with global capital. So I don't know who gets to decide. I think that editors and just they basically know. And these big PR firms, of course, are putting out this content as well and can choose to use those names. Yeah, regime implies a centralized control, a democratic power structure of a single individual. However, if they're a regime that is in favor of capital, we're not seeing corporate media denigrate them all that much.
Mm-hmm.
And unless they do something really awful like, you know, kill a person from the Washington Post and try to cover it up, that's given the Saudis a rather serious black eye. But to what extent, and Trump amplifies this, though, as well, I mean, the big giant Lockheed Martin doesn't want to lose their billion-dollar sales to Saudi Arabia and any of the other defense contractors, let alone the oil and agreement that's coming out of Saudi and the ability of the Saudis to raise oil production and lower prices and or reverse that at any given time. They are the functionaries for the U.S. Capital interests in terms of oil. And they were the main ones that got the oil to completely drop in price at the same time that U.S. was expanding its oil exports through fracking. So it didn't benefit us, but we wanted to see, and the ones that hurt the most were Russia, Venezuela, and countries that we wanted to see regime changes in. So that's a mechanism of manipulation that's ongoing.
Well, Peter, we've just scratched the surface here. Your book is really a powerful breakdown of the real power in the world. You have a great introduction from Professor William Robinson, and you provide this incredible detail. It is just so rich. And I encourage people to get a copy of Giants and pick it up. And I didn't try to read it all in one sitting. I don't think anybody should. I think you have to take it a little at a time and try to connect the disclosures and the revelations that you provide here with the current roles that we see these people playing on the world stage today. And it is a fascinating drawback of that curtain, in my opinion.
Well, Peter, I thank you for that. And, you know, yeah, it's very data rich. 199 names, you know, with paragraphs about these people all in 40 pages or 50 pages. Sounds like, oh, I could just skip that. But the important thing is not to.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you read those 199 biographies, at the end you go, okay, I get it. These people are the same. They're wealthy. They have these positions of power. And they're running the world, or the world runs for them, and governments are working on their behalf. So it is a insight into the global power elite that really hasn't been available to us at this level.
Well, it's an excellent piece of work, and I thank you for it. Peter Phillips, Giants, the Global Power Elite. Thanks for listening to this in-depth conversation with Peter Phillips. Send your comments to peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.